Welcome. You're tuned in to the best in true crime talk radio. This is True Crime Tuesday. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. Tim Dennis will join me in a little bit for more dumb crimes and stupid criminals. Now listen, we've been talking it up on our regular show, Beyond the Darkness, that through the entire month of October, every Tuesday, we're going back and putting up special throwback revisited episodes of True Crime Tuesday, talking about some of our most fascinating cases and some of our personal selections for weirdest stories. And today is no exception. Today we talk about the frustrated witness. Willis Morgan is our guest, and he talks to us about his belief in who the real abductor and murderer of Adam Walsh was. And it's a name that will be familiar to you for a whole different set of crimes. Could Jeffrey Dahmer have actually been involved in the Adam Walsh case? He makes a very compelling argument for that story. That's on Beyond the Darkness today. So you can get a double shot of True Crime Tuesday by listening to the brand new episode you're about to hear right now on the show and checking out Beyond the Darkness and checking out that brand new episode that's a special replay from about 4 years ago. So how do you do that? So you're only a subscriber to True Crime Tuesday, still not exactly sure about what Beyond the Darkness is. Go to our website, darknessradio.com. And there you can find our show. You can subscribe. You can also use our app if you have a Droid phone. We only have an app for Droids at this point. We've been working diligently with iPhone, but they're a raging pain in the ass to get anything done with. But we've got an app for Droid. It's called Darkness Radio. It's free. You can add it. It'll give you access to our true crime shows. It'll give you access to our Beyond the Darkness podcast. It'll give you access to other great ways to keep in touch with Tim and I. But we are the best in paranormal talk radio 5 days a week, Monday through Friday. And on those shows, we delve into the world of the strange and unusual, from cryptid creatures to mysteries and monsters to ghosts, demons, angels, mysteries, miracles, and wonders. We cover it all. But on this month, for Tuesdays, we're talking about some of the creepiest, weirdest crimes that we've ever covered over the years in True Crime Tuesday. Willis Morgan, the frustrated guest, is a guest on that show. But joining us today on Beyond the Darkness is, we're very lucky to have this man with us. His name is Stephen David Lampley. He's got a few books out regarding true crime and his hunt for justice in these type of cases. Stephen is a 21-year veteran officer and SVU detective with cases on networks like Investigation Discovery, True TV, The Discovery Channel, and in print media as the New York Times, LA Times, and the Gadsden Times. He interacted with serial killer Jeffrey Dahmer. Stephen arrested the Claremont Killer, featured on America's Most Wanted, and apprehended a fugitive from justice on Canada's Most Wanted, and worked closely with the FBI, the USPIS, the DOJ's, U.S. Attorney's Office, as well as the Alabama State Attorney General's Office under Troy King. He's here today to talk with us about his experience working serial killer cases and these type of crimes. Thank you so much for joining us today, Stephen.
Hey, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
I was talking about Willis Morgan and the frustrated witness, and there has been a lot said. Adam Walsh, of course, was abducted back in, I think it was the early 80s, and they believe they found his severed head. His father, of course, John Walsh, became one of the biggest crusaders for justice and children's protection and rights in America, so that death was not in vain. But the idea is that that case was closed with the naming of a murderer, Otis Toole. And Otis Toole certainly fits the bill for that kind of crime. But Willis Morgan believes that he can tie this crime very compellingly to Jeffrey Dahmer. Now, you had a chance to actually sit there and interact with Jeffrey Dahmer. And you said you're friends with Willis Morgan as well, correct?
Yes, that's true.
First of all, what do you make of his theory?
I have read Willis's book. As a matter of fact, he contacted me some years back as he was writing the book and wanted to talk with me about my experience with Jeffrey Dahmer. And we did it at length, and his book came out. I read it. He sent me a copy of it. And he does make, as you say, a very compelling case that indeed Jeffrey Dahmer could have committed this crime. Apparently, according to his book, there are several eyewitnesses, including Willis, that saw Jeffrey at the Hollywood Mall that day. So he does make a very strong and compelling case for that.
Now, as somebody who's worked in SVU and behind the scene on these type of crimes, the biggest red flag that people seem to throw is that this isn't the type of crime that he would commit. That Jeffrey Dahmer he had a type. And that's what he was caught, you know, doing. But there's been quite a bit said that he probably killed overseas and killed women at some point. He was an opportunist murderer. And that it did still fit his MO as he was growing and learning as a killer. How does that set with you as an investigator? Does that make sense? Do killers always have one type of serial killers always have one type, or do they adapt to the situation and surroundings they're in?
Most have one type. I mean, there are categories called organized and disorganized killers, and then there's also a mixed category. Usually they have a certain MO, but they do morph. They can be a organized killer and then become very sloppy, as in the case of Ted Bundy, and start morphing into a disorganized killer. Matter of fact, Ted Bundy's quoted, I forget the exact quote, it says, "You start out making sure everything's intact, and then later on you forget where you left the crowbar." You know, so they do change. They can change. So in the case of Eileen Wuornos, she's a female serial killer. Female serial killers' mold is that they suffocate or poison. Well, obviously Eileen was very handy with a handgun, so, you know, they don't stick to a mold necessarily.
What can you tell us about your interactions with Jeffrey Dahmer? How many interactions did you have, and what was the purpose for your communication with him?
Ours was social, casual. We were in we had been assigned actually to Fort Sam Houston together. We knew each other when we were in the military. My best friend and I were there for training as a medical and clinical specialist, and I don't remember what Jeffrey was there training for, but it was something different, as I remember. And we would often eat together at the mess hall, usually sit at the same table. And then on Fridays, we would almost always go to the NCO club and have beer, you know, pull a bunch of tables together, chit chat about what, you know, what went on the last week and sort of compare notes. So it was a casual relationship. And a lot of people will ask me, you know, well, what's Jeffrey like? What's knowing a serial killer like? And they ask the question almost as if they expect a serial killer to be some under the bridge ogre dragging their knuckles on the ground. You know, and that's far from the case. Serial killers are just like everybody else. They're normal, everyday folks. They shop, they go out to eat. Some have families, some don't. Jeffrey was a likable guy. I would be amiss if I said he was some kind of rude, obviously a serial killer, you know, we should have known. That's not true. He was a very likable guy, very quiet, very nice, very mannerly, and very intelligent.
Did he have any weird quirks at all that now in hindsight you can look back at and say, you know, I just thought he was a shy guy, but now that I know what I know about crime, that was a telltale sign?
Not really, no. I mean, he was quiet, but then, you know, there are people that are quiet. He was not, there was no one sign that even looking back now we should have known, you know, hey, that we should have said something. That there was, it wasn't there.
Well, then I want to know from your perspective, Stephen, I mean, as somebody who's been involved in law enforcement and has seen a lot and dealt with quite a lot, it's still different when it becomes something personal and somebody you know. Walk me through the moment you found out and the news came out about Jeffrey Dahmer and what he had been doing. How did you process that?
Well, it hit like a brick wall. And the way it came about, of course, I knew Jeffrey, and there were several other of us that got together with just he and I, my best friend, and several others that would get together, say, at the NCO club. And, you know, I don't remember if I knew the gentleman's name at the time. I don't remember that. But I was at home one day, and my best friend, who was also with me and was with Jeffrey as well, he called me one day. He says, Steve, do you remember the guy that used to sit across from us? Had the sandy blonde hair, aviator eyeglasses, was always quiet. And I had to think for a second. I said, yeah, I do remember him. Why? He said, well, do you know who he was? You know, I couldn't remember his name. And he said, well, that was Jeffrey Dahmer. Well, I sort of thought for a minute and remember looking back at his face. And then I immediately went online and looked at the photo. And sure enough, you know, I had not made the connection at that point. He had. And sure enough, it was Jeffrey Dahmer. And I just sat there and thought, you know, all the times that some of us went off base to go do things, I'm just you know, maybe nothing would have ever happened, but we never went with him anywhere. And I was thankful for that. And I don't know that he committed any murders at Fort Sam. I don't know of any cases of that. But, you know, a lot goes through your mind when you're in a situation like that. And I did think back. But it hit pretty hard, actually.
And as somebody, again, in law enforcement, did you feel compelled to reach out, do anything about that when you found this? Or did you just stand back and watch this horror show unfold?
Oh, this was after his death. He had already been killed in prison. So it was not much at that point, other than the fact
you weren't aware of the fact that he had been arrested and that was the Jeffrey Dahmer that you had gone.
I was not aware of who he was until after his death in prison. I was not aware of that at all. Of course, now when we knew him at Fort Sam, which was in, would have been 1979, according to all accounts and records, he had already committed one murder, but had yet to commit his others. The other 16, because he killed a total of 17. So, you know, Steve did not contact me until after the homicide and, his death in prison to tell me that that was him. And of course, that's history.
God, I can't even begin to imagine. And your group, you guys talked about this. I mean, that was one of your buddies, one of your cohorts. We talk on the show from time to time, Stephen, about, you know, I knew a murderer. And it's been surprising, but I guess not so much to Tim and I, just how many people that reaches out to. And we are still taking your emails. If you knew a murderer, or you maybe escaped a murderer, or were the neighbor or friend of a murderer, and you have a story to tell, please send it to me, dave@darknessradio.com. We may share it on an upcoming episode. But it's really kind of terrifying, Stephen, when you look at the fact that there are a lot of killers out there, and it seems to touch everyone's life. And I've even challenged people in conversation, you know, when we talk about the different shows I do. And I said, you know, we threw out the call, do you know a murderer? And they're like, God, that'd be horrible. Could you imagine knowing a murderer? And then they stop and they think, and they're like, oh, my God, you know, come to think of it, I went to school with a guy, or I know this woman who suffocated her husband at work. And you hear these stories, and it's a lot more prevalent. Murder is, it touches all of our lives in one way, shape, or another, whether it's a serial killer or a one-off murderer. Everybody seems to kind of have that 1 degree or 2 degrees of separation. Why do you think it's so prevalent?
Well, actually, if you go back and look at the statistics, the numbers, it is actually decreased. And if you go back to say the 1930s, there were a great many serial killings in the early 1900s, and it has decreased some, but even having just one is one too many. Of course, there's really no way to ever eliminate that. There's no way to ever eliminate any crime per se. I heard someone say, well, the way to stop child molestation, which is a area I was in latter years of my police career, is to lock them all up. Well, there's millions of them. You know, that's logistically impossible. So it exists. We do our best to try to find them before they kill, and that's not always the case. Matter of fact, it's almost impossible to do so. You don't know they're a serial killer until they're a serial killer. And by the FBI definition, that's three murders, three homicides over a period of time with a cooling off period. So, you know, we don't know we have a serial killer until we've had three homicides.
And how many cases have you been on personally that at first you think is just a one-off murder, but then it starts to escalate and you realize that you're now on the case of a serial killer?
Well, the Claremont killer was a arrest I made. He actually committed his crimes in San Diego, California. He killed six women there over a period of time. And the San Diego Police Department had him as a suspect and had him in their office interviewing him, I think twice. I know once for sure. And they did manage to get DNA evidence on him because the suspect in one of the murders left DNA evidence behind. Well, in the process of processing that DNA evidence, the Claremont killer got out of the Navy and came back to Birmingham, Alabama, which is where I was a police officer. Make a long story short, I was a utility officer at that time, and a utility officer is someone who is out of the academy, finished their training, but they don't yet have enough time on force to be assigned to a regular beat. So this was my last day on utility status. And the sergeant, bless his heart, in his infinite wisdom, decided that I would work the desk. You know, an officer's dream is to work the desk, right? So anyway, I said, no problem. I'll work the desk. Last time I ever have to do this. So I'm sitting at the desk getting ready the next day to go on my permanent assignment. And these two gentlemen walk in suits, and they identify themselves as San Diego detectives. And they're here to see one of our homicide detectives. So anyway, they met up and they go to the back of the precinct, and they're there, oh, maybe 20 minutes or so, and come back to the front. And they say, Stephen, we're going to go down to the housing project, and we need you to call this number. Now, let me go back a little bit. The night before, the Claremont killer, he had been arrested on the south side of Birmingham on Valley Avenue for stealing a carafe jar of tips. The San Diego Police Department had not yet entered the murder warrants in the computer. And so when he was arrested by the Birmingham Police Department, he was able to make bond while they were in the process of entering the warrants, and they missed each other.
Oh,
so,
unreal.
So, yeah, really, right? So he made bond and got out. Well, that's when they knew. Of course, San Diego came online and saw the arrest, so they knew where he was. They immediately flew two detectives out to Birmingham. And that's where we come in. So they're going to go down because of the arrest report and the information, the bond. They knew where he was living and his phone number, so they asked me, would you please call? We're going to go down there. When we get down there, we're going to let you know, and we want you to call the phone number and ask for him. If he is there or he answers the phone, let us know. We're going to go in, kick the door in, and arrest him. No big deal. Got it. So they go down. They contact me, and I make the phone call, and his mother answers. And, I asked for him. And she said, he's not here right now. Well, now, I'm a new officer, okay? I was a banker before I was a police officer. And this was not an option. Him not being there was not an option. He was supposed to be there. So I'm having to think pretty quickly. I've got a serial killer's mother on the phone. What do I do now? So I told her, I said, look, I'm a friend of his. Went to high school with him. And I heard he's in town. If you'll have him call me, I'd like to talk to him. Well, she said, oh, that's great. I'm sure he'd like that. And it was about an hour later that that phone line rang, and I looked at it thinking, you know, that could very well be a serial killer calling the police department. So I pick up the phone and answer it, hello, and it is him. It's the Claremont killer. So, I had to fess up. Said, look, you know, I'm not a high school friend. I'm a police officer. You were arrested last night, and we did not get all of the paperwork finished. And I'm sure I'm using a sales technique here, you know.
Right.
I'm sure you don't want us to send a patrol car to your house, do you? You know, no, don't do that. I said, well, if you'll walk in up here and let us finish the paperwork, we can just do it here. Although he called about five or six more times throughout my shift, and I had to look at my paperwork, 11:15 or 12:15. It wasn't long after my shift ended. He walked into East Precinct of the Birmingham Police Department voluntarily. And he was a nice guy. You know, the short time that we talked, he was outgoing, very well kept, very mannerly, very well spoken individual.
And you've got him there. You know what you're looking for. You brought him in under these kind of false pretense. I mean, how soon is it that you have to then pop on him why he's really back, and his response?
He asked why he was here. I said, well, you know, we got more paperwork to fill out. And that's when they told him, so, you know, you've got six murder warrants. And then, of course, arrested him at that point.
did he seem surprised by that, or like he was trying to, I'm innocent, I want an attorney. What was What was that moment
for
like?
Sure, yeah, but that's nothing different. A lot of criminals will plead their innocence. He acted surprised. But of course, the DA and DNA evidence in the court. Now, I did not have to go back to court in San Diego, which I guess was actually a blessing. Court is not one of the more fun things to do. But the DNA evidence, based on what I heard, was so overwhelming, and it was just. And he was there and had an eyewitness. So.
Now, tell me a little bit about the Claremont Killer, and he was featured on America's Most Wanted. What,
yes.
What was his crimes? I mean, to what depth and brevity did, you know, what was he doing?
Well, in a nutshell, he was following women home from a gym that was in the area. It was in the Claremont area of San Diego. And he would give them, of course, you know, when you go to the gym, you go home, one of the first things you're going to do is hop in the shower and get clean. And he would follow a woman home. Excuse me, follow a woman home and then give her, you know, just enough time, he thought, for her to get in the shower. And then he would break in to the apartment, go to their kitchen, get a kitchen knife or a butcher knife or some kind of knife out of the drawer and wait for them to get out of the shower and then commit his homicide. And of course, his MO was he would position the body in a certain degree. There were multiple stab wounds, usually in the upper left-hand chest, sometimes in the right-hand chest. And then he would leave. He would oftentimes take souvenirs, as they're called, like rings and jewelry, and some of that he gave to his girlfriend.
That had to be horrific for the girlfriend. I mean, could you even imagine? First of all, you find out you're with a serial killer. Second of all, you find out the gifts he's been giving to you are from the dead women he's been killing.
Yeah, that would certainly have an ew factor to it, I'm sure.
Now, what cracked this guy's shell? I mean, there has to have been. Maybe there's not. Maybe, you know, I mean, maybe that's the problem, Stephen, with true crime. We want there to be an understandable reason for the actions of these people. Was there an issue in his past that you can draw a line to and say, oh, you know, look, this can break a man. This can cause somebody to lose their mind.
Well, you know, the FBI back in, oh, I think it was 2006. I can't remember the exact year, 2003, 2006, hosted a symposium in San Antonio, Texas, and brought together 135 of the world's leading experts on serial killers. And their premise was that we're going to sit down and we're going to come up with this template that we're going to be able to use to identify serial killers. Well, they in their own admission, they failed. But what they did do is come up with a collection of characteristics of what serial killers have been in the past. And some of those were an unhappy childhood, disciplinary problems, and there's a whole host of indicators. But Cleophas's dad actually was a he may or may not still be in prison for homicide. So, you know, there's a family history of there, at least back one generation of committing murder. But, you can look at after the fact and look for things. But looking before the fact and identifying one it doesn't happen often.
Did he have a normal upbringing? Was he a normal guy in every other sense? It just that he had this dark line? Because it seems like with Ted Bundy, he was going out of his way to be normal most of the times, and then he would just relent to this darkness.
Yeah, Ted was a charmer, no doubt about it. He would, of course, Ted's MO was he would fake an injury to get somebody, a girl, to help him out or help him with something, and then he would lead her to his apartment or wherever it was that he committed the crimes, I'm not sure. And then that's when the switch would pop and become who he was deep inside and commit his murders. But Cleophas, you know, from what I remember, his childhood was fairly normal, except you have a dad in jail for prison. I mean, a dad in jail for murder. He joined the Army, joined the Navy. For all practical purposes, he did okay there. But indicators, not, there's no way. most times just to look at somebody and say, well, you know, they've got this set of circumstances. They're definitely going to be a serial killer. Well, that's not true. There are some indicators, you know, like if you have someone that's a loner, if you have someone that is a constant fire starter, there are things you can look at that indicate you may have, you know, you may have an issue, you may have a serial killer, but, you know, antisocial, a lot of serial killers kill animals. They start off with animals or arsonists. But now just because you have a arsonist who, you know, may mutilate animals doesn't mean that you're going to have a serial killer. So identifying a serial killer is very difficult before the fact.
Right. What are your thoughts? I mean, do you believe that a killer like Bundy, was he a monster who was struggling to put on a mask to be normal? Or was he a normal guy who was just battling with an inner demon that would once in a while win?
You know, I don't know. My thought would be that he was putting on the facade of being normal where he was actually not. You know, there was something in his background, something clicked along the way. But my thoughts are that his facade was being nice. His facade, you know, as far as coming across normal, was an act.
So the monster was really the one in control. And the mask was Ted Bundy.
Sure.
Very strange. When you start working a case that starts to evolve into serial murder, and you're looking at these cases, are they always easy to start to connect? Or does it take months before you realize, hey, maybe A, B, and C here have a direct connection to one another? They're all blonde, they're all blue-eyed, they're all prostitutes or waiters at Denny's, or, you know, I mean, is there, I don't think it's always so simple as it appears in the movies. It can't possibly be, right? Or we'd be cracking cases in 24 hours all the time.
Excuse me. Well, the investigators that I talk to and the readings that I've done and the experience that I've had with the serial killers that I've had, you have an MO. You have, and that's what you have. When you have the first three indicators, the first three homicides, you can most times pretty much tell because the serial killer has a motive, an MO that they follow, and you get a pretty good indicator pretty quick that this is a serial killer. You know, they stab a certain way, they do a certain thing, they enter a house a certain way. So you get an indicator pretty quick that, you know, this, you have a serial homicide here. But then again, you know, there's no set pattern that anybody's going to follow. It can be very random. You know, like I said, Eileen Wuornos, she's supposed to kill by suffocation and poison. That's what women usually do, but you know, she didn't fit that mold. So, but yes, most cases you can make a connection. You can link what they call case linkage. You can link the cases together sometimes fairly easily.
And when a case like that breaks, how many individual investigators do you have working on that case?
Well, it depends on the department. It's a team effort in any department. Usually, of course, the larger departments have more people. It just depends.
But on any given Sunday, I mean, like with the Claremont Killer, how many different investigative people were involved in how many different departments? I'm just trying to get a feel for what it really takes and the manpower and hours it takes to follow one killer like this.
Well, when you consider the forensics, when you consider the investigators, there's a lot of people involved. But as far as investigators, two, three, or four, depending. It's never hardly ever one. You want to have definitely more than one. But when you consider the whole team effort, you've got a good number of folks involved.
What are the first steps when you get called to a murder investigation? You know, again, we're going to put away what we see on TV, and I want to hear from an actual SVU investigator. What is the first line of protocol for you when you get on site?
Well, most of my experience has been with child predators. But when you're getting to a homicide scene, you know, police are already there. The medics have already cleared. The first thing you're wanting to do is preserve the scene or what's left of it, because you have a lot of contamination already because of the people that have come in and on the scene. So the first thing you want to do is protect the scene, preserve the scene as best you can, and collect all the evidence. That's the first step you want to do.
And when you're looking at evidence, how do you, you know, I mean, again, so many of us are jaded from Hollywood, right?
Sure.
You know, oh my gosh, I happened to notice that there was a matchbook laying on the floor over in the corner. How do you differentiate when you're at a murder scene from what's just garbage and what may be a real piece of evidence?
Everything's evidence.
Everything.
When you arrive on a crime scene, everything, you know, it's all evidence. You don't know yet. You collect everything. You document, you measure, you take photographs, endless photographs. You document everything on the scene because at the time you don't know what's evidence. You don't know what's important and what's not.
Okay. And how quickly do you start filtering? I mean, you've got to, you know, you take in all of these pieces you've bagged and tagged. At what point do you say, okay, this is just a matchbook? This is just a cigarette butt? This has nothing to do with the crime that we're investigating?
It depends. It's case by case. You don't know. You know, if you've had three other homicides and there's been a matchbook, unless you said, you know, talking about a matchbook left behind, then obviously that's important. But in the case of maybe another one, that maybe there's a screwdriver on the floor, I don't know. That wasn't in any of the others, but typically people don't leave screwdrivers on the floor, so we don't know. It depends on how the case progresses. It depends on what evidence comes back as being important. Is there blood on a particular piece of evidence? Is there gunshot residue, gunpowder residue on a particular piece of evidence? Is there a hair? Is there a trace evidence? It depends.
That's got to be a muddy, ugly puzzle to put together, right? Because then you've got to go through and investigate every strand or possibility, no matter how remote they seem, you know, all right, was the baby in the room? Was this happening? Was that happening? Just so you can kind of eliminate who's in. Have you ever at one point eliminated somebody only to recircle back and go, no, we overlooked this guy way too quickly. We got to go back at him.
No, I have not myself, no.
But you know people, right?
I've heard of it, yeah. I've heard of it, you know. And again, a homicide case, or any case for that matter, burglary, whether homicide, auto theft, whatever, any case as it evolves can change. You don't know, you know, you start out with what you have, you make your hunches, you make your best guesses, you take the evidence that you have, and then you go with it. And you go where the evidence leads and where the crime scene leads. And sometimes that can be a little misleading. So, yeah, crime investigations can change at a moment's notice even. It's the case of Cleopas Prince. They suspected one of the boyfriends and brought him in. You know, and of course, he did not do it. But you go with what you have and your case evolves as you develop.
Sure. Right, and you've got to at least eliminate these people. You have to take a look and talk to them.
It's not always about finding the suspect. It's about disqualifying others sometimes.
Right, exactly. Similar to what we do in paranormal investigating. It's not that we're looking for a ghost. We're looking for reasons that it wouldn't be a ghost. We're looking for easy strands of logic to disavow first and then see what's left over.
Exactly.
When a show like America's Most Wanted airs and they put things up and that's, you know, the Claremont Killer was featured on that show, did that expedite the ability to close that case considerably? Or I wonder if in a way, does it ever impede it by making it, the criminal aware, B, people more reluctant to come forward because they don't want to be featured on TV. They don't want to be featured to look like an idiot for not having known these things.
It did a lot of good. John Walsh, you know, as unfortunate as it is, the result was a good thing. America's Most Wanted was an excellent program. It apprehended, I think, over 1,000, I can't remember exactly, criminals. The Claremont Killer, I have to say that as far as their portrayal or featuring on the on their television show did not have an impact on his arrest. He was arrested, you know, like I said, because he had stolen a carafe jar the night before, got entered on the computer, then the San Diego detective saw it and came out. And it happens that way. You know, you can put somebody on an FBI list in the post office. Somebody may see it or they may get arrested on a traffic stop. But his show, John Walsh's show, was an amazing, amazing show. And it had apprehended so many.
No doubt. Criminals. All right. Well, we heard about the Claremont killer. Talk to me about the fugitive from justice on Canada's Most Wanted and that case that you were involved in.
Yeah, that was involving our undercover operation for child predators. I was at the police department one day. I'm riding around in my patrol car, and the chief gets on the radio. Police chief gets on the radio and says, "I want to see you at the police department." Well, with anybody, whether you're a police officer or in, you know, working for a private company, you immediately think, you know, what have I done wrong? immediately go right down the tubes. You know,
right?
I'm thinking, well, what have I done wrong? I'm going to, and I can't think of anything. I can't think of writing a ticket. Nothing I can think of. So I get to the police department. I walk in. The chief says, "I need to see you in my office." Well, it's really starting to suck pretty bad right now. You know, it's going downhill really, really fast. And so I go in the office. He says, "Close the door and sit down." Oh, here we go. I'm going to be fired for something I have no clue. And he proceeds to tell me. He says, "This is only between you and I. I want no one else to know about it. The city council's not to know. The other investigators not to know. The mayor's not to know. It's just between you and I." He said, "I want you to put together a whole new investigative unit where we go after child predators." He said, "Whatever you need, whatever resources you need, anything you have to have, you let me know. I'll get it for you." So, wow. Okay. You know, there's a big learning curve ahead. Long story short, we got the program underway and we started making some arrests. Of course, after you make an arrest or two, you can't keep it undercover all, you know, in the community, especially because, people start picking up on it and the jail, they hear about it. And so the anonymity of the program lasted until our first few arrests. But as I was identifying these child predators online, I was acting as a 14-year-old girl. And I know more about High School Musical than any adult male should rightfully know.
I don't know about that. I've got three daughters. I bet we could go toe-to-toe in a trivia contest and you and I will clean up.
But, you know, and in the process, you know, you've got to know these acronyms that they use in texting and online. You have to know about High School Musical. You have to know about high school now and the current trends. And I had to learn things that a 14-year-old girl would know. And anyway, we made several arrests under the profile of a 14-year-old girl, some out of state, some in state. And as I was talking to mostly male, there was one female the whole time, but mostly male individuals or suspects, it was becoming common practice that these males would ask me as a 14-year-old girl underage to take nude photos of myself and send them to them. Well, that's attempted production of child pornography. So I found myself very quickly being led into investigating child pornographers. And in that, I created another profile where I was a dad and had a 12-year-old daughter. I was a single dad of a 12-year-old daughter. And for money, because supposedly the profile was, the wife was the main breadwinner of the home. She left us. She left my daughter and I, and we're having a hard time getting along, financially. So under this profile, I was a dad with a 12-year-old daughter that I would rent out for money. Well, he responded to that particular profile, and he started asking questions. Of course, I answered, and he agreed to pay a sum of money. And we, in our discussions, our chat log, We discussed the fact that she likes stuffed animals and a certain type of candy bar and a certain type of drink, soft drink. And he agreed to meet. And the day of reckoning came around, he was on his way from, he was from out of town. He was a different part of the state. It took him about 3 hours to get to us. And pulled into the parking lot. And anyway, he was arrested. He had all the drinks. He had all the accoutrements that we talked about as far as evidence in the chat he had in his car, the money and small bills, which is what I requested. And in checking his background, he was a fugitive from justice from Canada. And right now he is serving on my charges. He's serving 14 years in federal prison on my charges. And when he gets out, he will be transferred to back to Canada to answer his 900 counts of possession of child pornography.
Wow. All right. You've got a unique perspective here. I'm a dad. You're doing this type of work. I applaud you because it's keeping the scumbags and dirtbags from getting to our children. Unfortunately, I know that with everyone you pull away, another one or two pop up.
Sure.
But how, I mean, this is something you have to finesse and take time in. How do you get rid of that icky feeling? You know, when you get done hot chatting some sick freak online as a 14-year-old girl or playing into their sick kind of game, That has to have an emotional wear on you.
You know, it, in a way it does, but I have to, you know, you have law enforcement officers, EMTs, firefighters, anybody in emergency services, you have to develop this distancing. You can't get personally involved. You'll ruin your life. You have to distance yourself from this. And I had several officers, what you talk about here, I had several officers say, Steve, how in the hell do you do that? Why don't you go out when you pick these people up or they come to you? How do you keep from beating the ever loving snot out of them?
Right.
I said, well, one is if I do, they get off. They're going to get off of the charges.
Right.
And number two, I'm going to find myself in prison.
Yeah.
What purpose does that serve?
You know? Exactly.
So I have to bite my lip and realize that I have to do the right thing. I have to, you know.
Well, that part I understand and I respect, and that's a tough gig. But the psychological damage to you, I mean, that's got to be something that is not easy to walk away from. It's not easy to just put away or compartmentalize and get home, take your hat off and watch TV and it not be playing and plaguing on your mind.
Well, it is. And it is nothing you don't forget. There's a lot of things in my law enforcement career that I'll never, you can't unsee things. You can't unthink things. There are things that will always be there. And when you're sitting behind a computer, I'm sitting in my office behind a computer and I'm chatting at all hours. It depends, you know, because my parents are out, quote unquote, my parents are out of town. So I'm online at 3 o'clock in the morning chit chatting. But you're sitting behind a computer and these, like I said, mostly men. I had one female the whole time I was doing this. You got this man and you have to understand I'm on a, back when Yahoo had chat, I'm on a generic Yahoo. I'm in a generic Yahoo chat room. I'm not in a sex room. I'm in a common social chat room. And of course, my screen name has the girls, my girl's name on it, 14. So it indicates that I'm a 14-year-old girl. I go online and within seconds, it's not even a minute, within seconds, I've got several males talking to me. They're either trying to groom me through the process of grooming or they're going right to the sex thing. But yeah, when you sit there and you see these men, and you start this chat, and everything, of course, is recorded. When you start this chat, and then they want to say, do you want to see my penis? Really? No, I don't. You know, not really. But I have to say, yeah, I've never seen one before or whatever. And you sit there and you watch these guys do these things. And you know that if it wasn't you watching it, it would be some other girl watching. So to see the vileness and the I don't know that I can come up with the words.
Right, I get it.
Adults would do. It has an impact. I won't say that.
Would you then try to cajole them to, well, how do I know that's really you? Show me your face with it so I know that I'm really seeing you. Would you?
Oh, sure.
Was that the main goal, was to get not just, junk pictures, yeah, but pictures with faces and any other identifying marks?
Yeah, certainly. Now, back then, before we had, we're talking, early 2000s, we did not have some of the technology that we have now. Back then, we had to order special software that I could screen capture with, and that I could record video, record the screen with. And what I would do is, while I was chatting in the Yahoo chat room, I would put the chat log over to the left. I would keep the video screen, if they were showing me their penis or whatever, masturbating, whatever they were doing, I would put the video next to it, and I would select that whole area as my recording, so that while I was typing, I could connect the video to the chat and see that while I'm telling them to, I would say things like, you're very cute. Will you smile for me or make a silly face? So I connected the chat with them on their face, and I connected their penis with their face. So I have, the cases I made were solid.
That's unbelievable. And it is so sick and tragic that there are adult men and women. Let's not just make it all about men, because there are female predators out there as well that are taking advantage of children. And it's horrifying. And how long has that been part of your world, that part of the investigation?
I did that for about 3 or 4 years. It was toward the end of my career.
When you compare that to other parts and other aspects of your career, no matter, going out and seeing homicide or suicide victims, what's easier for you to deal with, a straight up homicide or dealing with the sick sexual predators that you knew were preying on children, local children?
None of it. These memories that I have, and any police officer or EMT or a firefighter, it's not exclusive to me or one profession. Any emergency service, there's things that, like I said, you don't forget. You can't unsee, unthink, unexperience this stuff. But when you see an adult male who thinks he's talking to a 14-year-old girl and he wants to come have sex with you while your parents are out, or you look in the trunk of a car and you see a police officer's sister with her head blown off, or you see a 13-year-old kid in the back of his den who wanted to play Russian roulette with his friends, and friends said no, and he pulls the trigger and loses. All that, none of it's easy.
I give a lot of credit to you, and I know police are right now under a lot of scrutiny, and in some cases, rightfully so. And
sure,
but there are, there are bad football players, there are bad physicians, there are bad, fast food workers. There are people that will do horrible things in every position. Unfortunately, when you wield a badge and a baton, it makes it a little bit easier to let go. And especially in those high stress situations. But, I understand that the police are under a lot of scrutiny right now. But man, to hear what you guys have to deal with on a daily basis, you're doing the job really nobody else would rather do. I would rather work in sanitation and cleaning, toilet pipes than to have to face the kind of trauma and inhumanity that police officers see on a daily basis.
Well, it depends on the department you work in. It depends on what area you work in. But most police officers, EMT and firefighters, experience some degree of that. It's not easy, but you have to. They told us in the academy when I attended the Birmingham Police Academy in Birmingham, Alabama, that you have to not let it affect you. And of course, that's easier to say than do.
Yeah, right. But just don't let it affect you. Okay. That doesn't, that seems impossible. That's why a lot of police officers do end up turning to alcohol and substance to try to mute some of those thoughts.
Yeah, in my book, Outside Your Door, I mentioned that police officers have a higher rate of suicide, a much higher rate of divorce, a much higher rate of alcoholism, and it's all a quote unquote coping mechanism, at least the alcohol, of what they've seen and what they've had to do and what they've had to experience. We were fortunate, and Birmingham's not alone in that. I'm sure there are many other departments that do this, but the Birmingham Police Department, a wonderful, amazing police department, had chaplains, and they had a counseling program that if you felt like you needed to talk to somebody, it was free. Here's a number, call, come in, let's talk. And they told us, and they brought our families in. It was amazing. We want you to, bring your family. We had family night after the academy, and they talked to the families. This is what your husband or your wife is going to be going through. We want you to know. But there are programs for most police departments, and maybe all, I don't know, but there are at least programs for most police departments where officers can go and talk to somebody and get help. But as far as Birmingham, another thing they told us is that when you go home in the evening, you find yourself a rock, you find yourself a tree, you find something that's going to be there. And when you're on your way home, you drop off all the homicides, all the sexual predators, all the suicides, all the robberies, and you go home to your family and you leave that stuff there. You don't take that home with you. And when you come back the next day and you're going to work and you pass that rock or they're past that tree, pick it back up and bring it to work with you, but don't take it home. Of course, again, that's easier said than done, and a lot of officers can't do that.
Right.
But you try to separate yourself as much as you can, and it does affect officers.
Well, as a real investigator, not just a beat patrolman who's out handing out tickets, not that I'm demeaning that position, but as an investigator, your mind has to constantly be turning and churning and trying to put pieces together. So to take it off when you get home, that has to be impossible, because you can't. There's really no off time when you're in the middle of trying to solve a crime.
There's not. It's, you're sitting at dinner and you're thinking, or you're sitting on the beach and you're thinking, and all these thoughts go through your mind. You're right. You're constantly thinking about it. And it's also the same with a beat officer. You're thinking about things that you went through. Could you have done it differently? What could have happened? You're always playing scenarios, always.
You cover in your books, and you've written how many total books now?
I have 3 books out now, another one coming out here in a few days, be out Halloween.
All right. And in the books that you cover, talk to me a little bit about what kind of gave you the points for each one. And I know you covered a couple of books on dealing with liars and how to see through deception. You know, there's so many different ways and aspects of that. What did you bring to it that you felt people really should be aware of?
Well, in the book, How to Detect Liars, it's a quick read. It's not a very involved. It's mainly a checklist for people who want something quick. They don't want a whole 300-page volume of all the details. They just want something quick and easy of what to look for. And that's what How to Catch a Liar is. I cover things such as eye shift, eye movement, hidden face, arms and hands, word uses, semantics. Pronoun usage is a big thing sometimes, as far as switching pronouns from personal pronouns to proper names and back. False incident questioning, where you yourself lie about an incident to see if they agree with it. So, it covers a lot of information. It even covers some hints to look for when texting, as far as lying. And it's been well received. It was my first book. And my first book was Outside Your Door, which is a collection of stories some of which we've talked about already, that are in my book of my police career, cases and street stories as well. Outside Your Door was actually my first book. And I have a few author friends who kept telling me that, and I was going to go the traditional publishing route with it. I was looking for a literary agent and a publisher that would take the book. And some of my publishing friends, or excuse me, author friends said, no, you need to self-publish. And I immediately think about self-publishing as vanity, and I'm going to pay somebody $5,000. That's not the way publishing works. You publish a book, you get paid. You don't pay somebody to publish your book. So I checked out I won't call the name, but it's a rather large online retailer, and self-published my book. Didn't cost me a penny, and ran it through their program. I was very, very well pleased with the lying book. I wrote that one second to test the system, just to see if I was going to like it or not. So, but Outside Your Door is a collection of police stories. It includes a story on the Claremont killer. It includes a brief thing on Jeffrey Dahmer. We talk about the fugitive from justice. There's some cases in there. On other cases, there's also some humor. It's not all gloom and doom. There's some comedy in there, some humorous stories. And then I have my last book to be published is Serial Killer, Inside the Mind of a Serial Killer. And it also is sort of like the first book I had published. It's not an in-depth thesis, an end-all be-all to serial killers, but it does give you information as, you know, what to look for. The early warning signs, we discussed a little bit about what to look for in a serial killer, what a serial killer looks like as far as the victims, what they're looking for, talk about their IQs, a bunch of male versus female serial killers. It's a compendium of a very, very brief book that covers all of that.
All right. I know we don't have a whole lot of time left together, but dealing with the crimes you worked on, throughout your career and all the different aspects of the crimes, is there, you know, I mean, there's got to be points to you that this was a highlight for me. This crime, cracking this specific crime or ring or person was, a career topper for me. Tell me a little bit about one or two of the instances and cases that you dealt with that really mean the most to you.
There were two. The Claremont killer. Of course, I was not involved in the investigation so much as I was the apprehension, but being able to sit there at a desk and know that you were able to have a serial killer, maybe the only one in history, I don't know, to voluntarily walk in a police department, I was happy with that. I was very happy with that because I don't know how long, or maybe he ended his killing career. I don't know. But I often wonder if he was left on the street, would he kill again? Would he kill somebody in Birmingham? We'll never know that. And that's a good thing, I guess. The other one was a case involving a police officer's sister who was murdered. And we ended up involving NASA with that to undigitize and make the photo at the ATM machine a lot clearer. And we were able to, we had a horrible, horrible picture. Horrible picture of a suspect at the bank through their ATM machine, and NASA was gracious enough to take that photo and enhance it. And we were able to look on there and see the details of her shirt, the restaurant logo where she worked, and it was just an amazing case. And we got these three people off the street.
Is it amazing to you that it's 2017 and our cell phones can take crystal clear high def pictures, but our bank tellers and CCTV still take grainy, crappy 1967 Bigfoot footage?
It's amazing. Now, there are some banks out there that have really great systems, but, and my wife, for instance, my wife, ex-wife now, she left her purse in a car, and a gentleman stole the purse and had a gun in it, of course. And the ATM machine again, and even in the case that involved us, was horrible. But yeah, it depends on the system. You know, banks sometimes have good systems. It's been my experience that they have pretty sucky systems as far as video and photos.
You can tell you definitely have a Southern mentality because you just referred to a criminal as a gentleman that took your wife's purse. Because this douchebag reached in and took my wife's purse. It was, yeah, a gentleman reached in and took. You have a different perspective on it, that's for sure. Do you find that working, and especially when you're working cross cases, you know, with other states and other countries, like with Canada, do they seem forthcoming in wanting to try to help you crack some of these crimes? Or do you butt heads a lot with other law enforcement when trying to, you know, you're both on the same path?
Yeah, most times you get cooperation. Now, when we arrested the gentleman, the scoot douchebag that was on Canada's most wanted and was the fugitive from justice. We contacted Canada. I did not. I believe it was our attorney general, general's office under Troy King that did. It was my indication of what I was told that they really weren't wild about getting him back. And I sort of understand that. We got a guy here, excuse me, in our prison system now, and he's wanted in Canada for 900 counts, 900, almost 1,000 counts of possession of child pornography. I can sort of see they don't want him back, you know? you keep him. You got him now.
Well, that begs another interesting question, Stephen, right? If, okay, you've got him on a lesser charge. Mm-hmm. And he should follow through for that crime. But if Canada's waiting to extradite him and bring him in for 900 more, why? Hear me out. Why don't we give them back their criminal so that they can foot the bill for the criminal and it's not something bleeding our government? Give them back the crime. Okay, we got him. We've put him away. We have 14 years. We'll give him to you. He has to at least serve 7 of our 14 years before yours can go in, or some kind of transaction like that seems it would be a fair testament, but it would relieve the pressure from our prison systems.
Well, that's true. And again, I was not in on the negotiation or between Canada and us, but it was my understanding at the time that we would go ahead with that and let him pay for his crime here in our country and then transfer up there. But, you know, like you say, would it not be easier? Yeah, it would save us a lot of money as far as incarceration. He's doing federal time, so he will do all of his 14 years. There's no good time with federal. So, he will do his entire 14 years.
Well, I applaud people like you that do this type of work and can come home at the end of the day and live a relatively normal life. And I hope, are you finding the books to be cathartic in letting this information out and kind of dealing with your past and what you've had to live through and see?
You know, I really haven't thought of that much, but in essence, yes, probably Outside Your Door has been, and I wasn't going to write the book, to be honest. I was not going to write any book, but my friends kept after me, you know, knew my background and said, you need to write a book. I'm like, look, let me make something perfectly plain to you. I'm not writing a damn book. It's not happening, you know? But they kept on. Finally, I said, look, I'll write the book. Just be quiet. All right. Just shut up. just shut up. I'll write it. And I was going to write it and sit on it and not do much with it. But anyway, yeah, an answer to your question, I think it has been. I think it's stories that sometimes I don't talk about, but now is out in the open. I think to some degree, yes, it has been.
Well, I thank you very much for being a part of our world, sharing your stories and giving us some insight into something that thankfully 90% of us never have to know about or deal with. So I think that's why there's such an interest in true crime is trying to educate ourselves and gather an understanding. Do you feel that you've come at all in all of these years closer to understanding why people do horrific things, or are you still astounded daily by the news that breaks of the travesties and the inhumanities that we share with one another?
Police officers have a saying, don't underestimate anybody and don't say you've seen it all. Once you say I've seen it all, somebody comes around and makes you realize you've not seen anything yet. There are things, for instance, the Las Vegas situation. I won't get off on that. I've got my own opinions of that. But, you know, he doesn't fit the mold. He doesn't, they're not finding a real reason why. In most mass murders, there's a pretty quick, pretty obvious reason why. This was different. Yeah, there's always something comes along that you don't understand or that you've not been trained for. So yeah, there's always something coming along.
Do you ever see a story break, a crime happen, and they're at a standstill, and you think, you know what, I might have some insight on this? Do you ever make that call to the police and try to help out, or know that they probably have enough on their plate and don't need you bothering them with yeah, other thoughts?
There are enough people out there far smarter than I that are working these cases. I don't stick my nose in.
Well, the books are out and available. Stephen David Lampley, Outside Your Door, is true crimes from the career of a 21-year police veteran. And as we said, he's got a few other books out there on detecting liars and how to catch a liar. So you could check all those out. We'll have links up on our site, so that way you can find our guest and his books. It's been a pleasure, sir. Thank you very much, and thank you for serving and doing the work that you've done over the years.
It's been my honor and an honor to serve as well. I appreciate your time, and thank you for having me.
We should open up the bags of dumb crime, stupid criminals, Tim. Maybe one day we'll keep one of these officers on with us to give us some actual insight on what they think of these morons and the type of crimes they commit. But let's get started. It's time now for Dumb Crimes and Stupid Criminals. Well, first up, Florida man. This is a follow-up story, Tim. I should mention this because this is definitely one of those stories we needed to know the final outcome.
Oh, yes.
And as soon as I say the headline, you'll understand why.
Okay.
Florida man awarded $37,500 after cops mistake glazed donut crumbs for meth. Remember that story last year?
I do, yeah.
Yeah, where they were sure of it, put them away. $37,500. Yep. Florida man comes out on top in this story, Tim. How about that? Sounds like a joke, but, well, it's not. Back in December of 2015, 64-year-old Daniel Rushing had just dropped off a friend at chemotherapy and was driving home an older woman from his church who worked at the 7-Eleven and would otherwise walk the 2 miles home. As Rushing drove away from the convenience store, police pulled him over. The officer said he'd been driving 42 miles per hour in a 30-mile-per-hour zone and had failed to come to a complete stop before entering the roadway. When Rushing handed over his driver's license, Officer Shelby Riggs Hopkins noticed his concealed weapons permit. Rushing confirmed he had a pistol, and she asked him to step out of the car for her safety. Now, the officer then asked if police could search his car, and Rushing said, sure, if it meant he wouldn't be ticketed. Rushing watched as the officers, who now numbered 4, conducted a very thorough inspection of his car. Finally, Riggs Hopkins said to him, you want to tell me about what we found? There's nothing to find, he said, confused. But Riggs Hopkins had noticed some crystals on the floorboard of the car. And when officers used a field testing kit, the white substance tested positive for methamphetamine. Rushing said that was impossible. I've never even smoked a cigarette, he protested. The officer showed him the substance in question, and Rushing was aghast. Well, that's glaze from a Krispy Kreme donut, he explained. I got one earlier on Wednesday, which makes a lot of sense of why they're so addictive, Tim.
Oh, they are a lot like meth.
Turns out their glaze is methamphetamine. Officers weren't buying it, though. Rushing was booked on charges of possessing methamphetamine while armed with a weapon. As he sat in jail, he asked himself, Lord, what am I doing here? It was funny, Rushing said, because I called my wife to tell her what happened, and the guy next to me waiting for the phone started to laugh. He said, this is crazy. I think you got a real good lawsuit here. He spent more than 10 hours in jail before being released on bail. Orlando police sent the evidence it had collected from Rushing's car to the Florida Department of Law Enforcement for further testing, which determined that, just as he'd said, the white crystals were not a controlled substance. Results did not indicate whether the substance was sweet and delicious, though, Tim. Now, what happened to good old-fashioned TV police work where you lick the tip of your finger, you dab it on the crystals, and then rub it into your gum so you know if it's pure. Right?
See, remember? Dave, you can't do that, though.
Why? Immediately given away the fact that it was not methamphetamine and it was, in fact, crack that we call Krispy Kreme.
You know why, Dave? Here's why.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are some drugs that are stepped on either with baby laxative or rat poison. And so when a cop goes to do that, it can be either laced or poisoned, and you can actually end up killing yourself by doing that.
Yeah. Do you want to know the real reason that they don't do that, too?
Why is that?
Well, there's twofold. I have friends that are cops, and I always ask about that. I go, when you find the pack of heroin or coke, do you give it a cut and put your finger in and rub it? And they all laugh, and they go, no, that is the stupidest thing, because we are all subjected to drug testing. And that would definitely show up in our blood or in our urine stream. Second of all, if you rub pure cocaine into your gums, your mouth would go numb within seconds. And you'd be like, I'm the best. Everybody's going to jail today. So they never would do that. He said you rub cocaine, that's what they used to do, you know, in bare knuckle boxing. Remember back in the day when men were men and women liked it, Tim?
Yeah.
What? Bare knuckle boxing.
Uh-huh.
I think they just used to call it bare knuckle fighting, where the guys would square off, no gloves. It was just fisticuffs, right? What they would do was they would rub baking soda into their gums and tongue, which would open up the pores. Then they would rub cocaine in, which would numb their entire face and allow them to take much more punishment than they ever should.
Hmm.
These are useless thoughts by Dave Schrader. Yeah, but that's true. Weird stuff, huh? All right.
Yeah.
So, again, let's check this out. Orlando police sent the evidence that it had collected from Rushing's car to the Florida Department of Law Enforcement for further testing, which, again, determined that, just as he said, the white crystals were not a controlled substance. All charges against Rushing were dropped. Now, it would be a funnier story if it hadn't been so closely replicated in Oviedo, a Florida city northeast of Orlando. Carlos Cash was pulled over in March for driving without headlights and arrested by Oviedo police when court records showed that he was out past his court-ordered curfew. Those records were later shown to be out of date and inaccurate, ABC affiliate WFTV reported. Police saw white dust on the floorboards of Cash's car and tested it with a field kit. The substance showed positive for cocaine, Tim. Cash went to jail for 90 days. 90 days in which he knew that the white substance in his car was simply drywall dust. I know for a fact it's drywall dust because I'm a handyman, Cash told WFTV. I said that continuously during the arrest stop. Police in Orlando and Oviedo, like many other law enforcement agencies, use inexpensive field kits to test for drugs. Orlando's police use NIC brand, N-I-K brand narcotic testing kits, a NIC general screening kit which tests for opiates, meth, and other drugs. And it costs just $18 for a box of 10. Yeah, that might not be the best way to go.
I don't think so, no.
No, but such roadside test kits are far from foolproof, as we've just proven. A 2016 investigation by ProPublica and the New York Times found that tens of thousands of people are sent to jail each year based on the kit's results, which often generate false positives. Some tests use a single tube of a chemical called cobalt thiocyanatin.
I see.
Mm-hmm. It's scientifical. You can look it up, yeah. Tim. And it turns blue when it's exposed to cocaine. But cobalt thiocyanate also turns blue when it's exposed to more than 80 other compounds, including methadone, certain acne medications, and several household cleaners. Other tests use three tubes, which the officer can break into a specific order to rule out everything but the drug in question. But if the officer breaks the tubes in the wrong order, that too can invalidate the results. The environment can also present problems. Cold weather slows the color development, heat speeds it up, or sometimes prevents a color reaction from taking place at all. So, data from the state law enforcement lab in Florida found that 21% of the evidence recorded by police as methamphetamine was not, in fact, methamphetamine, Tim. And that half was not illegal drugs at all, according to the ProPublica investigation. When we examined the department's records, they showed that officers faced with somewhat ambiguous directions on the pouches had simply misunderstood which colors indicate a positive result. Now, those findings are part of what spurred Rushing to file a lawsuit against the city of Orlando after charges against him were dropped. 2 weeks ago, Rushing says he reached a settlement with the city for $37,500. I thought, well, that was very Casey Kasem of me. Did you hear that, Tim?
Yeah, it was.
A settlement for $37,500. And now the Jeffersons theme, we're moving on up.
Casey'd be proud.
Thank you. Yeah. I thought the lawsuit was the right thing to do for what they did to me, he tells NPR. Yeah, let's see. This guy spent 10 hours in jail and he earned $37,500, Tim. An Orlando police spokeswoman says that after the Rushing incident, the department conducted an internal investigation and officers received additional training in using the field kits, but it's still using the same NIC narcotic test kits. The Safariland Group, which makes the NIC tests, told ProPublica that it provides all law enforcement agencies with comprehensive field testing training manuals in addition to its instructions, and says its products are not intended for use other than directed. These training materials, which outline protocols for use, clearly state that the tests are presumptive aids that serve only as confirmation of probable cause and are not a substitute for laboratory testing, the company wrote in a statement. For his part, Rushing bears no ill will towards the city's police department and says that the arresting officer was very polite and nice. He worked alongside the police as a Parks Department employee for more than 25 years, and his brother is a former Orlando cop. He says the issue is that the department keeps using the kits despite the well-documented problems with using them. These kits give false positive one out of every five times, he said. I'm thinking about running for state house next year, and if I do, I'd like to get something done about these kits. With the lawsuit behind him, Rushing's next step is getting his record expunged. He says he'd like to find more work in security, but it's hard to get business with a record showing an arrest for possession of meth while armed. After the glazed incident, Rushing stopped by his local Krispy Kreme to let the people know they might be in for a little publicity. Sometimes they give him a free donut, but I don't eat them in the car, he says, laughing. Oh, God. Tim, I've been in your car. If we ever get pulled over and they start testing the things that are on the floor of your car, we're going to prison. We're going to, I see Krispy Kreme. I see Dunkin' Donuts glaze. I see, it's like romper room here. I see, bits of fluid from most likely, sodas or no, not, you're not on sodas.
No.
Red Bull. Probably going to show up as liquid cocaine, Tim.
Either that or we're going to get rich, Dave. You're not looking at the silver lining in this cloud.
Yeah, but you know what'll happen is two moron radio show hosts arrested, they become the dumb crimes and stupid criminals in their own story. So then we will still have to get over that hump eventually. I mean, we will be exonerated and cleared, and we could make a whopping $37,500 before taxes, Tim. Which, if I add it correctly and kick off my shoes, that's about $32,000 more than we've ever made in radio.
Right. See? Right.
Not a bad deal. I might just go out with a little glazed sugar rubbed underneath my nose to try to incite the cops to test me. What you mean? What you mean? Look at it. It's just glazed donut, yo. You didn't know I could sound so urban, did you? I've been listening to a lot of The Rap, Tim.
Have you? The Rap?
Yeah, I've been listening to The Rap. Uh-huh.
Yeah. Huh.
Yeah, that Two-Pace.
Yeah.
Two-Pace Jacker. Yep. He's pretty good.
You gotta check out the ice cream. That guy.
That whole noir is pretty good too. I think that's Nigerian for something noir.
Yeah.
They're very angry about the police in that song, but rightfully so. They probably got busted for Krispy Kreme dust, Tim.
They did. As a matter of fact, Dave, they did.
A Texas man has been charged with a felony theft after investigators linked him to an odd plot. Are you ready for this, Tim?
Wasn't Odd Plot a Bond villain?
No, that was Odd Job, but very close.
Oh.
First of all, if there was a food that you could get away stealing, let's say $1.2 million worth, what would that food be?
Big Macs.
Really?
Yeah.
Really? You would want $1.2 million worth of Big Macs?
Sometimes you get a craving.
I would probably do the McRib, I'm not going to lie.
Yeah.
I do love me McRibs. I haven't seen McRibs. I think they're gone. I wonder if they got arrested for methamphetamine possession and they're not allowed to come back to the stores in Minnesota.
Probably.
All right, Tim, check this out. A Texas man was charged with felony theft after investigators linked him to an odd plot to steal more than $1.2 million worth of fajitas over 9 years.
That's
what the Brownsville Herald reported. I mean, I like me some fajitas, Tim. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
I like to get my Mexican on, if you know what I mean. And fajitas, whatever you want to call them, potatoes, potatoes, they're delicious. They're sizzly. Who doesn't like to get a cast iron plate delivered just inches from your face?
Oh, geez. No, not like that.
Hopping and popping and doing the crocodile rock right in front of you, Tim. And then you get to make your own delicious little meals. Why am I tipping these people? All they did was bring me the fixins. I had to build the damn thing myself. But I'm on a tangent. Let's get back to the story. Former Cameron County Juvenile Justice Department employee Gilberto Escamarillo missed work one day in August for a medical appointment. The same day, a delivery driver called the kitchen about having 800 pounds of fajitas to drop off, the paper said. A woman informed the driver that the juvenile department didn't serve the Tex-Mex food, but the driver said he'd been delivering it for 9 years. Cameron County District Attorney Luis V. Sanez told the Herald. When Mr. Escamarillo reports to work the next day, he's confronted with the discussion, and he admits he'd been stealing fajitas for 9 years, Tim.
Wow.
You got to love a food a lot to steal over $1 million worth of food over 9 years. Escamarillo was fired that month and arrested after investigators obtained a search warrant and found packages of the Tex-Mex food in his refrigerator. They also checked invoices and determined he would intercept county-funded food deliveries and deliver them to his own customers, according to the newspaper. He was determined to have stolen $1,251,578 worth of fajitas, Tim.
Jeez.
Escamarillo was arrested last week on a felony theft charge. If it wasn't so serious, you'd think it was a Saturday Night Live skit. But this is the real thing, Sinez said. I wonder if he also had about $2.8 million worth of Imodium AD that he was delivering to his clients as well.
My God, I don't know. Mm. If you think about it, most of that was just onions and peppers anyway.
Right, that's what I'm saying. That's a lot of – how do you steal $1.25 million worth of onions and peppers?
Yeah.
That's a whole lot of stuff.
I was just thinking to myself, 800 pounds of fajita pretty much describes one of my exes.
Wow. Police in Sherwood Park are looking for a thief with a pants full of meat, Tim.
Oh, yeah.
Wow. I better not go shopping in that store. You know what I'm saying, my friend? Because I'm packing the meat every day. Oh, shut up. All right, Strathcona RCMP are asking for the public's help identifying a man accused of filling his pants with stolen meat.
But haven't we all?
According to police, between 1 p.m. and 1:10 p.m. on a Saturday, September 30th, a man entered the Costco warehouse at 2201 Broadmoor Boulevard in Sherwood Park, headed to the meat section, and put several packages of meat in the coveralls he was wearing. Well, obviously, these are green coveralls. He's wearing a green hat, and he was in Sherwood Park, Tim. This was Robin Hood. He was simply stealing meat from the rich to give to the poor. The man left without paying for the meat in his pants. Oh, we all end up paying for the meat in our pants someday, Tim. Strathcona RCMP are releasing surveillance images to the public in the hope of identifying the suspected meat thief. Anyone with information is urged to contact Strathcona RCMP.
Did they say whether he was packing salami or he just stuffed a little shrimp in there, Dave?
No, it's quite a bit of meat. And he's wearing like, he's wearing his like those hip waders, not even hip waders, like right underneath the, because I don't know much about the fishing, but it comes like right underneath the man boobs.
Yeah.
And they're like those hip wadery looking kind of pants with suspenders.
Yeah.
That's crazy. Yeah. Here's a good follow-up story to that, Tim. Deputies report that a woman found a naked intruder in her home eating what, Tim? You're a naked intruder in St. Augustine, Florida.
Yeah.
You break into somebody's home. What's the one thing you go looking for? What's the one thing that can quench your craving when you're on a burglary high, Tim?
I know the one thing I'm not eating is crackers because it'll get in the chest hair.
Right. And, you know, the other worst thing, you can't whistle to your driveway guy, your getaway guy.
Right.
Because you got a mouthful of crackers and you're like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I would say a nice sandwich, Dave.
A sandwich. Okay, that's a good plan. Yeah. Maybe a steak if you could find one. I don't know, pork chops, right?
Yeah.
Well, St. Augustine woman came home to find a naked intruder in her home eating her canned pineapple. Deputies say that when they arrived at the house on Thompson Bailey Road, the suspect, Mary Hamilton, told them the door was open for me to come inside, according to a report from the St. John's County Sheriff's Office. Hamilton, 63, now faces charges of burglary and theft following the incident last Wednesday. The homeowner, upon finding the intruder, went outside and locked herself inside her car while she called authorities. Deputy, would you be that intimidated if you walked into your home and there was a naked woman eating a can of pineapple? Would you feel you have to go out to the car and lock yourself in? Are you afraid she's going to come at you with a spoon?
I might sit down and join her.
The homeowner, upon entering, went outside, locked herself in the car while she waited for authorities. Deputies also determined that Hamilton entered through the homeowner's front door, took a T-shirt belonging to the victim's son, and ate leftover food from the fridge before opening the can of pineapple. It doesn't appear the homeowner and Hamilton knew one another. However, deputies learned Hamilton lives only about a half mile away from the victim. Hamilton was taken to the county jail in what we can only describe, Tim, as swift justice. That's right. Were you a fan of Breaking Bad?
You know, I didn't see too many episodes of it. I've been meaning to go back and watch
it. Oh, you've got to watch it. It's such a great show. But man, you know, here's something funny, right? If you don't want attention in the world, don't buy the Amityville Horror House, right? If you don't want attention in the world, don't be the house that they used for the Brady Bunch, right? Maybe you'd rethink. Right. They'd have to pay me a lot of money to use my house so that it would be one of the most recognizable houses in the world.
Yeah.
Well, the people that own the house from Breaking Bad, they're now putting up a fence because people can't stop throwing pizzas. Fans of Breaking Bad, you no longer can have nice things. At least tourists making a pilgrimage to Albuquerque, New Mexico, Tim, and visiting the house in which unexpected drug mastermind Walter White once lived will no longer be able to snap the photos they seek and will probably also have limited opportunities to toss pizza onto the unassuming abode's roof, as was famously done on the show. The owners of the single-story home are fed up with the constant tourist traffic and impositions and are constructing a giant 6-foot wrought iron fence to guard against the attention. That's according to local KOB4 news reports. We don't want to gate ourselves in, homeowner Joanna Quintana told KOB4. We're the ones who are being locked up. But with hundreds of visitors passing by over some weekends, they've decided it's time to make a change. We feel like we can't leave because when we do, something happens, and that's ridiculous, she said, citing instances in which tourists take landscape rocks, request that a garage door be closed, or ask the homeowner to leave the scene so they can better snap a picture. Show creator Vince Gilligan even made a public plea back in 2015 for people to stop throwing pizzas on the roof. But even 4 years on from the show's finale, clearly some fans just can't get enough. What? It's been 4 years already?
I guess.
Oh, Tim, time keeps on slipping, slipping, slipping into the future.
Mm-hmm.
No good. A man who thought students threw a plastic bottle at his car was so angry he attempted to climb on the bonnet of a moving school bus to berate them. After not being let in the school bus to confront the students, he thought that through the bottle, Laverne Duran attempted to stop the vehicle by jumping on the front of it, according to the police. This all led to a bizarre video in which Duran is seen holding onto the bus as it slowly moves forward, slamming the bonnet and demanding to be let in. Fearing for the safety of his students, the Maryland bus driver refused to stop and moved towards a nearby police station before an off-duty officer intervened and Duran was arrested. The 68-year-old now faces charges including destruction of property and disturbing the peace. Baltimore County Police Sergeant Andrea Bylan told WBAL-TV, "We happen to have an off-duty officer who was present in the area who assisted and intervened quickly. He came over, separated all the parties, and at that time the suspect was arrested on scene without incident." Now, Tim, let me just take a quick second if you don't mind. I know there's no commercials on this show,
okay,
but we do have a public service reminder. And this is in all seriousness, folks. For the last 5-6 years, something that's been near and dear to our heart, we love to do things for charity and help out where we can. And one of our favorite programs is Second Harvest Heartland. It is a food delivery service, a kind of a community service food program for people in need. And right now in America, we have more people in need than ever with raging wildfires and flood damage and storm damages. We need more help than ever right here in the good old U.S. of A. So we work with Second Harvest Heartland, whose buying power is so strong that when you donate $1, that $1 will go to feed one person 3 square meals in a day. Tim, I don't care if you've been stealing 1.25 million of fajitas. You still can't feed people 3 meals for a buck, even on that much fajita meat.
No?
No, you can't.
Oh,
so this is what we're doing. Every year we do the Halloween for Hunger campaign, and we go back and give to our communities. And this is what we need from you folks. Go to the darknessradio.com website, darknessradio.com. Last year was one of our most, vigorous goals. We wanted to hit $5,000. And that's a pretty good size goal, kids. That feeds 15,000 people. We wanted to hit $5,000. We crushed that goal with your help at almost $13,900, basically. That's huge. Well, we know this year we're even bigger. We've got more listeners around the world than we've ever had before. So we know we can get that number. $15,000. That's what we're asking. Literally, if everybody listening to this show just donates $1, you will help feed somebody 3 square meals. One of your friends, neighbors, country, Roman men, whatever, it will go to help people right here in our country, in our backyards, in the heartland of America. So please go to darknessradio.com, click on the Halloween for Hunger campaign button, and make a donation now. Any size will do. Really, I know you're thinking, oh, yeah, like a buck's going to really help. It will. Trust me, if 15,000 of you donate $1, we're going to supply 45,000 meals for people in need. That's huge. So please help us help you and your friends and relatives and neighbors. And let's turn things around. Let's put a little bit more light in the world and come together for something. All right, so please do that. Darknessradio.com. And then click on the Halloween for Hunger banner to make that donation. And remember, today is also True Crime Tuesday Revisited on Beyond the Darkness. So you can check out, when you're at darknessradio.com, you can check out our episodes right there on the left side of the screen. You can stream it and listen to it. We go back and reexamine the Adam Walsh case with Willis Morgan and Mia Taylor, and they talk to us about a very intriguing part of the story. Willis Morgan is the frustrated witness who believes he has cracked and solved this case once and for all. And I think you agree, Tim, with the evidence that he provided, it is probably one of the most compelling stories in cold cases. I mean, they've technically closed the case by saying Otis Toole killed Adam Walsh.
Yep. Yeah.
But Willis Morgan made a pretty compelling case for the fact that they got it wrong and explains how and why. So go check that out on Beyond the Darkness. You can find links to that at Beyond the Darkness, or I'm sorry, darknessradio.com. And remember, we have a free app. This isn't an ad again because it's free. We have a free app for Droid users. So you can go check it out and just go to your Google Play Store and download Darkness Radio. That's really a cool app. It's going to give you access to Beyond the Darkness. It's going to give you access to our Darkhives. It's going to give you access to True Crime Tuesday. It's also going to give you access to the Tom Bernard Show, which I'm a part of every Tuesday. And it's going to give you access to the Legends Show with Jeff Belanger. That's right. We're going to be an official home for that. You can find it on our app. If it's not up already, it will be very soon. And you'll be able to find all those on our free app. So go check that out. Download it and get it now. You can't get the True Crime Tuesday show free. Again, this is a subscription based, but you can stream it from that application as well. So it's there for you. Go take advantage of it. All right. I've got a couple more stories and we'll wrap up for the day. Tim, are you ready for this?
I'm ready.
Criminals, man, we got to catch them all. We got to catch them all, Tim. We're going to Hotlanta. A man is behind bars after he pulled out an axe in Buckhead Target and then used it to rob the store, according to police. Atlanta police said the employees were fearful as soon as the man pulled the sharp blade, but investigators say the crook made a critical mistake during his getaway that landed him in police custody. Funzale Woods was arrested after using an axe as a weapon at the Target store on Piedmont Road in Buckhead, according to police. Investigators said the man walked over to the electronics section where he took a cell phone out of a package and proceeded to put it in his pocket. When he was approached by the manager, he actually presented an axe. The manager, of course, backed off, and Officer Lisa Bender, Atlanta Police Department, Woods then ran out of the store. The 911 alert went out to Zone 2 officers. By then, Woods had changed his shirt, but he didn't change his backpack. "So I think that's what got him," said Officer Bender. "The man took off running when he saw police, and he did have on a Pokemon backpack, Tim." So those are normally a bright color and typically easy to spot. Woods allegedly showed his weapon to one of the officers, but apparently figured that it wasn't such a good idea. Yeah, that's not a good plan. Don't pull your axe out on the cops, Tim.
Not only that, but don't show them your Pikachu.
Yeah, exactly. It was too late to make the getaway, but by then several officers surrounded him and took him into custody. Gotta catch them all, Pokemon. And since we're talking about dumb things, Tim, this picture alone is worth $1 million. I love this picture. Would-be car thief abandons Hulk hands on steering wheel. Hulk brash. A man spotted inside a Pasco, Washington residence vehicle early Monday morning quickly fled after being confronted, only to leave behind a set of styrofoam Hulk hands still clutching the wheel, KOMO reports. Confirming they didn't belong to the car owner, Pasco police said of the giant green gloves, they were not inside the vehicle before the prowl. An after credits scene unfolded about an hour later when just two blocks away from the scene of the crime, an officer spotted the alleged Avenger turned intruder who matched the description given by the car owner. Upon being arrested, Ariel Contreras was discovered to both have a warrant and be in possession of paperwork stolen from the vehicle, in addition to an odd variety of items. The 33-year-old was booked into Franklin County Jail for the warrant, as well as new charges of vehicle prowl and possession of stolen property. It is awesome. So there's a photograph of inside the car, and as though a zombie has torn the person from the wheel, leaving nothing but their hands, to Tim. The Hulk hands are still grasping the wheel of this vehicle.
Poor Hulk.
Yeah, Hulk is mad. All right, we're going to wrap up with one more moron, Tim. And believe it or not, he's from Florida. Pinellas Park sheriff deputies on Monday arrested a man accused of robbing a bank near Largo last week, then using the money on utilities, rent, and a drug binge. According to the Pinellas County Sheriff's Office, William Joe Johnson, 26, of Thursday... on Thursday stole, I'm sorry, they ran it all together, Tim, T-U-H-U-R-S-D-A-Y-S-T-O-L-E. That's why I thought they were giving me a town there for a second. Let's try this again. According to the Pinellas County Sheriff's Office, William Joe Johnson, 26, on Thursday stole an undisclosed amount of money from Achieva Credit Union at 10125 Olmerton Road. Deputies arrested him Monday night on the robbery charge at the Express Inn in Pinellas Park. Johnson entered the bank just before 11 a.m., approached the teller, implied he had a gun, and told the teller to give him cash. According to the deputies, he ran from the store with the cash. After an investigation, deputies found him at the hotel. In an interview, detectives said Johnson told them he was in need of the money and searched on Google how to rob a bank. Yeah.
And he got the answer?
Apparently, deputies booked him into the Pinellas County Jail at about 3 a.m. Tuesday in lieu of a $100,000 bail. I wonder if Google, for morons, it puts that out, like how to poison your wife or how to rob a bank. I wonder if they give bad advice and make those like among the first ones easier to catch people. Do you think they do that?
I'm sure.
That is so weird. People are so dumb. Well, that's it for us this week, kids. I hope you enjoyed the show. We've got more great programs coming your way. As a matter of fact, next week, Tim, we have a true crime story with a paranormal slant. How about that? Yeah, we're getting closer to Halloween, so I thought I'd dig up a couple of creepy ones. And next week on Beyond the Darkness, our True Crime Tuesday Revisited, how about a case of possession, Tim? And a case of possible, case of murder and possession and John Lennon, Tim. How about that? How does that grab you? Right.
Yeah.
Next week, we're going to revisit one of our very first episodes of Darkness Radio. Long before we had the idea of True Crime Tuesday, we were visited by medium Chip Coffee and Maria Simpson, who shared a very chilling story. Maria was actually friends with, what's his name? Mark David Chapman?
Yeah.
And the man that assassinated John Lennon. She tells us a different story about this man, but believes that he was dealing with real demons. And we shake her paradigm during that interview, if I remember correctly. I bring up a point that left her very uncomfortable. And from my understanding, she never really did another interview after we brought that up, Tim.
Really?
Yeah. So, although it's not an official True Crime Tuesday show, it does talk about one of the world's most famous crimes, the murder of John Lennon, from a totally different perspective. And I think you guys are going to enjoy that. Later on in the month on True Crime Tuesday Revisited, Tim, a case of young serial killer and a 400-year-old werewolf. How about that?
Gotta like it.
Beyond the Darkness, you can check that out again at darknessradio.com. And all Tuesdays, all throughout the month, we're going to be doing the True Crime Tuesday Revisited there. Plus, you'll be getting brand new episodes of True Crime Tuesday here. And this is one of those bonus months, kids. You get an extra Tuesday. That's right. Extra Tuesday. Extra Tuesday. Extra Tuesday right here on True Crime Tuesday. Five of them this month, Tim. And I'm not going to skimp. I'm not going cheap on them. I'm not just going to give them four episodes, because we tell them, you sign up $5 a month, you're paying just $1.25 per episode,
mm-hmm.
right? This yeah. month, you're getting five episodes for that $5. I mean, you spent only $1 per episode to get amazing, imaginative entertainment like this right here. Okay, maybe that's not the best sell of it ever, but we're going to give you a whole nother episode this week. And every month that there's five Tuesdays in the month, you get that additional episode at no extra charge. No extra charge. No extra charge. You're good. How do you come up with those audio bits so quickly, Tim?
I'll just forewarn you, you're wearing out my special effects budget here.
Yeah, special effects. Special effects.
Yeah.
We do need a bigger budget. All right. Well, that's it, kids. Be safe. Be kind. Love one another. We'll be back next week with more of the best in True Crime Talk Radio. For that guy, I'm this guy, and you've been listening to that show.